All right, we are remain on the record in open session. This date, May 29th, 2013. And we'll now consider the matters entitled Secretary of Labor versus Knox Creek Coal Corporation, docket numbers BA 2010-81-R through 113-R, with the exception of docket number VA 2010-102-R. We'll also be considering docket numbers VA 2010-131-R through 133-R, docket number VA 2010-166, and docket number VA 2010-214. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Nakamura. And we're going to have a discussion of the cases presented by Linda Gosel. And I understand, Linda, we're going to break down the discussion into sort of three areas to make it easier, because we do have, as reading on the record, you can understand, several dockets involving different violations. And I believe what we're going to do is first have Linda discuss the background and the facts related to violations pertaining to permissibility standard.
That's correct.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. The Tiller No. 1 mine, an underground bituminous coal mine located in Cedar Falls, Virginia, liberates in excess of 900,000 cubic feet per hour of methane in a 24-hour period, and is subject to Section 103I spot inspections every 10 days. In January 2009, the mine had a safe ignition. At issue in this proceeding on appeal are five violations which the judge found were not significant and substantial, or SNS. The first three violations involve 30 CFR Section 75.503, which is the Secretary's permissibility regulation requiring all safe equipment to be maintained in permissible condition. On November 20, 2009, MSHA Inspector Michael Colley issued citation number 8169155, alleges an SNS violation on the continuous mining machine located on the 003 MMU due to an opening in excess of 0.004 inches in the plain flange joint on the lead junction box. MSHA Inspector Jason Hess issued citation number 8170363 on October 30th, 2009, alleging an SNS violation on the continuous mining machine located on the 005 MMU for an opening in excess of 0.004 inches in the trailing cable junction box. On November 4th, 2009, Inspector Hess issued citation number 8170375, alleging an SNS violation on the 005 MMU continuous miner because it had an opening exceeding 0.004 inches in the conveyor motor cover. The judge concluded that each of the three permissibility violations were not SNS. He rejected the secretary's arguments for an assumption of the occurrence of an explosion within the enclosure housing the electrical components on the equipment when considering the SNS designation on permissibility violations. Applying NAPIs, he held that each of the three permissibility violations, the secretary proved the first, second, and fourth elements. Knox Creek committed a violation of a mandatory safety standard, the violation contributed to a safety hazard, and the injury would be of a recently serious nature. The judge identified the hazard as methane could get into the compartment. An electrical malfunction in the compartment might ignite the methane, flame could get into the atmosphere, and if the methane outside was in the explosive range, ignition and perhaps explosion might result. As to the third NAPIs element, although the judge found that given the gassy nature of the mine, sudden methane buildup in the explosive range could reasonably be expected to occur, the secretary failed to establish the reasonable likelihood of an ignition inside of the enclosures. He reasoned that the secretary failed to produce any evidence concerning the frequency with which the electrical malfunctions of the equipment causing sparking or arcing described by the inspectors occurred. He therefore concluded that the secretary failed to prove the reasonable likelihood that the hazard would result in an injury to my guest. The secretary argued that the judge erred in concluding that the three violations were not SMS by failing to assume the occurrence of an explosion inside the enclosures, causing the electrical components. Knox Creek responds that the judge correctly applied the Matthews test in considering whether the violations were SMS and that substantial evidence supports the judge's findings.
Thank you, Linda. We'll start with Commissioner Nakamura.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The first thing I'd like to do is thank Linda for her help in this matter, and to tell you that I'm going to continue to need it, because as I sit here today, I'm still wrestling with the issues with respect to permissibility. We'll probably most likely vote to vacate the judge's decisions in these cases, but I'm struggling with the basis for it. The judge's decision was issued in December 2010, just shortly after the commission's decision in Musser Engineering and PBS, in which there is a portion which I'll quote in a minute. That indicated that or clarified the Matthews analysis. And since that time, we've also issued another decision in the Cumberland Coal case involving a primary escapeway, in which we cited approvingly to the PBS case. The parties... certainly the judge did not cite to Cumberland Coal, since it was issued after his decision, and I do not believe he cites to the PBS case as well. And the parties probably didn't at that time brief him on that particular case. But even so, in this case, in the appellate briefs, I failed to see a reference to the analysis of PBS. Of course, none to Cumberland as well. And I understand that there is an appeal of the Cumberland decision to the circuit court, so that which is still pending. Be that as it may, in PBS and Cumberland, we looked at the Matthews test, and of course, I think everyone knows the four elements of the Matthews test, which is violation of a mandatory health or safety standard, which usually is not an issue, and is not an issue in this case. A discrete safety hazard, that is a measure of danger to safety contributed to by the violation. And we always also state that it's the contribution to the cause and effect of a hazard that must be significant and and substantial, that the violation must contribute in a significant and substantial way. And then three, the reasonable likelihood that the hazard contributed to will result in an injury. And four, a reasonable likelihood that the injury in question will be of a reasonably serious nature. Now, in PBS, we stated that the test under the third element, which is the reasonable likelihood that the hazard contributed to result in an injury, so we said, quote, the test under the third element is whether there's a reasonably likelihood that the hazard contributed to by the violation. And in that case, let me finish the sentence, will cause injury. And in that case, the violation was the use of an outdated mine map of an old mine. And because this particular map was used, they didn't, I think, know exactly where the old mine works were. miners, unfortunately, I guess, dug into the old works and it flooded the mine, causing certainly hazardous condition of drowning and injury and possibly death. And what we said in PBS was, and I think the company argued that you would have to prove that using mind maps, there was a reasonable likelihood that using old mind maps would cause injury. And we pointed out that's not what the Matthews test says. It says that there is a reasonable likelihood that the hazard contributed to will result in an injury. And we pointed out that the hazard in that case was the danger of breakthrough and resulting inundation, so the flooding. That's the hazard. The violation was using the map, and under the second part of the test, that significantly and substantially contributed to the hazard. So if you, and in Cumberland Coal, we reiterated and we quoted from PBS that the violation in that case was the, I think there were problems with the lifeline in the primary escapeway, and the hazard as framed by the judge in that case was miners not being able to escape in the event of an emergency. We then looked at that hazard, miners not being able to escape, and there was testimony and evidence that proved that if miners had problems escaping in the event of an emergency, they could suffer injury of a serious nature. So if we use that analysis here, the violation in this case is having a gap in these, the first one I guess being the lead junction box of greater than 4,000ths of an inch. The issue would be, does that significantly and substantially contribute to the hazard, which the judge described as an ignition or an explosion? So we would have, the judge would, to try a fact in these cases, would have to make that determination, and that may be a factual determination. For example, I guess in the Texas Gulf case where we did not find S&S because there was no methane in that mine, according to the record, there could be a finding that it did not contribute or significantly or substantially contribute to that hazard. So that seems to be a finding that the judge would have to make in this case. When you get to the third step, where the judge actually, you know, made this critical decision in this case, the question is whether the hazard of an explosion or ignition would result in an injury. And I don't know whether it would be obvious that it would, but there at least have to be evidence put on of that fact, I think. So I think the way the judge analyzed it, and he did it in a way that where we do have numerous cases where the judges have gone through the same kind of analysis. But since the PBS case and the Cumberland case, it seems to me that that analysis is not correct. Although, like I said, the Cumberland case is up on appeal. Although, as I understand it, the secretary is actually arguing in that case for an assumption, as opposed to looking at or basing her arguments on the analysis we did in Cumberland. So, and let me say this one. even the judge's analysis in this case seems somewhat inconsistent to me when you look at the analysis in elements 3 and elements 4, because he says the primary issue is whether the secretary proved a reasonable likelihood that the hazard would result in an injury. And then he says, obviously, there can be no reasonable likelihood of an injury without a reasonable likelihood of an ignition. But on the other hand, earlier in the decision, he said he finds that it's reasonably likely that the injury would be serious. And, you know, you could ask, but isn't it obvious that there could not be a reasonable, it would not be reasonably likely that there would be a serious injury if there's no reasonable likelihood of an injury? I mean, it's, I may be confused you there, but it just seems to me that at least for element 4, he assumed that there was an ignition or explosion that occurs that would cause a serious injury, relative to element 3, which also uses a reasonably likelihood language, he doesn't do that. So, so in any event, at this point, I think that in light of our prior precedent, the decision needs to be vacated and reviewed. And it may be that maybe we should have done this earlier after the Cumberland decision was issued, but be that as it may. I'm still trying to decide the exact, order that I would vote for. But as I say, based on our precedent, I think the decision needs to be vacated on this one and the other two.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Young?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I'd like to especially thank Linda, who's spent a lot of time going over the issues in this case with me, and in particular drumming up some old law and reminding us that we've said a lot about significant and substantial in the past. I would agree with Commissioner Nakamura that the case needs to be vacated and remanded. I don't agree with the judge's analysis on the issue, but I believe I have maybe some difference of opinion with him on why that is. I think it's important that we remember that we're an adjudicatory body and we're undergoing a constant barrage of pressure from the secretary to presume that anything bad that might happen is going to happen, and that certainly simplifies a lot of the problems that come before us in making it unnecessary for us to make evidentiary findings and conclusions, for our judges to do so, for us to rule on whether they've done so correctly. I don't think that's the right approach. I know it was a scarring and traumatic experience the last time they tried it, but if the Labor Department wants to make a definition of significant and substantial that's more precise and meets his intention of what the protective purpose of the standard ought to be, there's always the regulatory process. We've had the Matthews test in place for decades. It's generally served us well. There are some interesting and difficult problems, especially in the emergency context, where a safety feature has perhaps little or no relevance in the absence of an emergency. But this is a routine and everyday case that we're looking at in this situation. To draw on the Musser analogy a little further in getting my position here, I think that we would all agree that if there were no water in the abandoned mine workings and nothing to inundate the mine, then it might not have been a significant and substantial problem. to have an out-of-date mind map and run into the old workings. It certainly wouldn't have caused the catastrophe that we all were gripped by back in 2003. So I think that that's something that we have to consider. Because the facts of the particular situation must come into bear in determining whether something is significant and substantial. Similarly, in permissibility violations, as the one here, I think we would all agree that if this were not a gassy mine, we could not necessarily say just because methane, if it were present, could get in there, there'd be a danger of an explosion, because you'd have to have a situation where you would show the danger of the methane. Texas Gulf was kind of an odd case because you had really almost a unique geological situation where it was extremely unlikely for any methane to be produced. But those are the facts in that case. In a given case, the circumstances have to take into account everything because we required a confluence of factors. And we've also, in looking at this, recognize that it's not a snapshot, and that's really the basic problem I have with the judge's analysis, is that he finds that there's not a defect in these components at that moment. But the reason I think the judge's decision needs to be vacated is that you had testimony from the inspector that the components in these boxes will wear down over time, driven by rust and vibration of water, and the stresses of everyday activity through normal mining operations. And we can never know when that could occur. I mean, the constant struggle that we have with the Matthes test is really our frustration at being able to do the impossible, which is to predict the future. So we're struggling with trying to identify what is a reasonable likelihood. And we've held that it's more than just a substantial possibility. We've not approved of a formulation in that vein, but we've also held that it doesn't mean anything near more probable than not to occur. I think that what we need to do is look at this case in particular with the permissibility violation and focus on the word reasonable. And reasonable is a very elastic concept, but it takes into account a lot of things. And when you look at something like the reasonable person standard, you look at what a reasonable person would think about and consider and do. And I think when you're talking about a reasonable likelihood is one that requires you to focus on the anticipation of the event. If the facts of a situation are such that a reasonable person would have to anticipate and take steps to prevent the confluence from occurring, because it's foreseeable under those circumstances, because of the facts in that case, then I think that a reasonable likelihood may be made out. And so I would reject the Secretary's argument that we need to presume this because otherwise it could never be shown in a permissibility case. I think it could be shown, and I think perhaps it was demonstrated here with the evidence from the inspector. I think that's something that would have to be addressed on remand, where the judge would be reminded that we need to look at what happens in the context of continued normal mining operations. Is the possibility significant enough? Is it real? Is it a looming danger, not an imminent danger, but something that could develop without your knowledge, because these boxes are enclosed and you don't see them, and you don't regularly take them apart and inspect them. Day by day, something's happening in those boxes. Usually it's just normal electrical connections being made and everything that needs to keep the machine functioning happening. But, you know, we wouldn't any of us be here ever. We wouldn't have jobs if everything happened the way it was supposed to happen, or if we could predict when things were going to go wrong. But the fact is that machines malfunction all the time. You can't predict that. Well, what you can predict is that machines will malfunction at some point. The permissibility standard functions as a safeguard against that. You want to keep the methane from getting inside these boxes because you don't know the condition of the components and because the components may tend to break down. That's the evidence in this case. I think the judge failed to take that into account given the facts in this case. And so I would vacate and remand for an application of our decision looking at the confluence of events. And the confluence here is important because when you have these hazards that are compound in nature, you're never going to have an explosion without all of the things of being in the same place at the same time. You need an ignitable or explosive level of methane. You need oxygen. You need an ignition source. Or you're not going to have a true hazard. But in a gassy mine, you don't know when the methane is coming. But you know it's going to be there at points in the mining operation. You know, they have face ignitions here. And I think that this is a gassy mine. And you take special precautions in those situations because you know about that danger. And you also know that these components are going to break down over time because that's what happens in the course of normal mining operations. Whether it's on the track to occur is one thing. But what we don't know, the thing that's not going to change is that the joint was large enough to allow a methane ignition to escape that box and to perhaps lead to a greater catastrophe. When you look at the possibility of that occurring, it's devastating. The judge recognized that, and as Commissioner Nakamura pointed out, that if there were an injury-producing event, it would be a tragic and horrible one, most likely, in a gassy mine. We've consistently held in other contexts that the degree of care required by a reasonable person increases as the degree of danger increases. And I think that's something that we need to bear in mind as we sweep in all of these cases on significant and substantial in the Matthews test and try to understand what it means. So I'm not going to presume anything is going to occur, but I do believe that the judge did not fully account for the facts of this situation as the mining operations would progress, and so I would vacate and remand on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. I would reverse the judge's determination that the permissibility violations are not SNS. I think that, first of all, the commission's precedent on prior permissibility cases, I know we've had a couple of cases, they may both have involved U.S. Steel and gassy mines, where one, they both were similar. One was a loose bolt on the plate that was covering the enclosure. One was a headlight on a piece of face equipment that was loose. And in those decisions, the commission upheld the SNS determination and really just pointing out the danger involved with the potential for an ignition in the enclosure occurring when you've got the electrical components in there, and then if you don't have the integrity maintained, the point of the permissibility requirements is you basically make those electrical equipment parts explosion proof so that if something does ignite within there, that it doesn't reach out into the greater atmosphere of the mine and continue to ignite methane that might be present. And the decisions are very short, sweet. There's not a lot of debate and angst. I feel that the to vacate and remand, I'm not sure that I've heard what explicit instruction the judge would follow and what mistake the judge made. And I think that in doing his analysis. And I think that there is trouble. It can be difficult applying the Matthews analysis, and I think that it's not always clear how one applies that. And I think in some cases, although we've said we're applying Matthews, it's really amounted to applying an assumption, considering the event, the fiat event, that the standard is directed against. It's also, I think, difficult for somebody to understand that are they supposed to determine if the event, if there's a reasonable likelihood of an event occurring, and that, in fact, is different than a substantial possibility of an event occurring. I'll be honest with you, I was a philosophy major in college. We kind of wrote papers on that kind of thing. Right. Sitting here today, I don't think I could tell you. I know there's a commission decision, that rejected something that was only a substantial possibility of something occurring. And I thought to myself, well, substantial seems more stronger than likely, and possibility seems less strong than likelihood. So a reasonable likelihood, is that really different than a substantial possibility of something occurring? I know I would have difficulty saying it met one standard and not the other. I dare say an Emption Spector in a mine would have tremendous difficulty determining, making that kind of determination. I also think that to say that the judge failed to consider certain facts, like, well, the electrical components will wear down over time. I mean, I believe the record in this case, the operator was showing that the components were not worn down at the moment in time, and they were taped, and it really was unlikely they would cause a spark at that time. To say, though, that you need to consider that they could wear down over time, and they will wear down over time. I mean, that really would be testimony that would be offered in pretty much every case. I mean, that is the purpose of the standard. It is. It's sort of considered that you do have the wear and tear on these components, and I do. I have concern. I consider the fact they are in this enclosure. I mean, during the course of the mining, I'm not sure, but I don't think they take these plates off all the time, to look at the condition of the wiring. And so, really, I think you have to err on the side of caution, and you do have to kind of think, well, these could wear down over time. And as Commissioner Young pointed out, then you do have this catastrophic possibility of just if there were a spark. I mean, it's not something that you're observing developing necessarily. If something would go into a defective situation with this wiring, and then in a gassy mine, you have the possibility of gas being present. And so then you have the components of a methane explosion. So I'm not sure what on this record that I've heard today, why it would be vacated and remanded. I mean, to tell the judge you have to consider the fact that the evidence that this could always happen, it could deteriorate, well, I agree, and I would consider it here. And if we're saying in light of that, it would have to be S&S, then there really isn't a point in remanding it. I think that, like I said, I will be giving serious thought to how I write an opinion. As it turns out now, I guess I may be dissenting because I would reverse. But, I really do think that to say that, in PBS, I mean, of course, the point there was the event had already occurred. The inundation did occur. the feared event that the standard of is partly directed against had actually happened. So in one sense, you could stand back and say, did the failure to have an accurate map contribute to that? Well, yeah, presumably if they had an accurate map, so they were mining toward a flooded mine, they would not have continued mining toward the flooded mine. Now, the trouble is, then you move to cases where the event hasn't happened, thank God. I mean, in most cases, the emission spectre is in the mine, and the event hasn't occurred. I mean, and sometimes it does take a confluence of certain events occurring. But in Cumberland, we said, well, we didn't come out and say that we would apply an assumption of looking at an emergency situation, and in that case involved the use of a lifeline, and a problem that they had not adequately maintained the lifeline, the section of the mine. But we said, well, the hazard contributed to by the defectively placed lifelines necessarily involved consideration of an emergency situation. Now, you know, think about that, a lot of people think, it's kind of, are we really doing people a service? Well, but that's not an assumption. I mean, I'm just not sure that, you know, to be intellectually honest, that we may need to say, yes, in these types of violations, you really are considering the wires being defective and creating a spark. And then this gap in the plate is a SNS violation because it would then allow the ignition to ignite methane in the mine. And I'm not sure that's much different than saying, well, we're not doing an assumption. We're looking at the particular facts of this case. However, we're also considering that in every case, and it's just kind of inherent in the situation, where you have wires and they're contained in an enclosure in electrical equipment, and there's movement and the environment, and there's some moisture that can lead to rusting and can lead to defects in the wiring, then that is a factor that says that it's S&S here. I mean, it would be hard to imagine a situation where that would not be the testimony in the record. So, in that case, is it not coming down the same way as just sort of assuming, yes, and a sparking and ignition can occur within that enclosure, even though the point in time, as my colleague pointed out, it does seem wrong. It seems problematic to just freeze a point in time, take off the lid. You know, Emsh's in the mine, and he cites them for having the gap too wide in the enclosure. And to take off the lid of the enclosure and say, well, these wires are in good shape right now, so it can't be S&S. I agree, that's problematic. So, I guess I would just point out that I'm not as disturbed by the argument that the Secretary makes that the appropriate context in which to weigh these violations and determine whether they significantly and substantially contribute to the cause and effect of a mine hazard, as the statute states, is to place them in the context of, yes, we have wiring that can deteriorate, that can cause a spark, and if the gap in the lid is too wide, it can ignite the methane in a gassy mine. And I would point out that also this would be consistent with the Commission's holdings in prior cases. Thank you. Linda, I would also thank you for your help. I know we've wrestled around this, and you've been very helpful in pointing things out in the record and just kind of engaging in discussions and doing some research. And like Commissioner Nakamura, your job is not done. I say that even though I have very capable counsel helping me, but I may be writing separately, but I may still ask for your assistance in determining things in the record and checking factual things, etc. Thank you. Is there anything?
Next violation includes the Shirley Cable on the Inspector Colley issued citation number 8169156 on November 20th, 2009. Alleging an SNS violation of the CFR section 75.572, requiring power wires and cables to be adequately insulated and fully protected, because the trailer cable of a continuous mining machine had a 1/2 inch opening in the cable, exposing the insulated power conductor. The opening was located 10 feet from the machine. The citation also states that the mine floor of the section where the miner was located was wet, and that the cable was handled by miners during the course of each shift. The judge found that the violation was not SMS because the evidence did not support that miners were exposed to the hazard before the inspection, as there was no way of knowing whether the opening of the cable occurred before the cable was last moved. In addition, he stated that because the machine had not been operating for 2 days and was being repaired at the time of the inspection, the opening in the cable would have been noticed and corrected before the machine was returned to service. The Secretary contends that the judge erred in concluding that the violation was not SMS because he assumed that the operator would have detected and corrected the cut in the trailing cable before returning the continuous miner back into service. He also argued that the judge impermissibly considered that the continuous miner was de-energized, when the inspector specifically testified that the equipment was energized and moved for repair during the maintenance shift. Knox Creek responds that substantial evidence supports the judge's conclusion that no miners were exposed to a hazard, and that based on normal mining conditions, the continuous miner would have been inspected and the cable repaired before being put back into service.
When we say in the record that you just said that the continuous miner was out of service, that must mean it just wasn't in use at that time?
The mine was not in production the prior 2 days before the inspection.
But there wasn't any kind of tag out or something like that that sort of put it out of?
No. It was during a maintenance shift that the inspection performed,
but no, it wasn't specifically locked and tagged out. And the assumption is that it would be placed in production the following
hours after the maintenance shift
on the oncoming day shift, which was the production shift. And
there's
nobody contested the fact of the violation?
No.
So it's... Okay. Well, I would vacate the decision of the judge based on the assumption that the operator was going to abate the violation. I think there are cases certainly that hold that have been cited, and I'm not sure how you could reasonably make that assumption especially with respect to the continuous miner, and the fact that the I guess the miner was not in service, but on the other hand, it was there and not locked out and tagged out. They found the violation, and I think the inspector has to look at it from the point of view of the condition of that trailing cable at the time he cited it.
Well,
So I think in using the Matthews factors as the judge did, but without the assumption of the abatement, I think, well, I'll have to look to see whether or not I could reverse on this one as opposed to remand. But I would certainly vacate the decision as it stands as of now and then reserve judgment on that as I look at it more carefully.
I would at least vacate it and possibly reverse, and I think I would lean towards reversing the judge for the reasons Commissioner Nakamura stated. I think he's got an insightful line of questioning there that highlights for me that it might be a different situation if this equipment had been tagged out specifically because of the cable problem, so that the cable problem could be repaired. You might make an argument that abatement was underway, the equipment wasn't in service, and in that case, I don't even know if it's a violation. I don't think it is, but that's not the situation here. And you know, A, we've held you can't presume that abatement is going to occur because of vagaries of human behavior, and B, we have so many cases that evidence how that vagary comes into play. You know, specifically including cases for inadequate inspections. You can't assume somebody's going to do a good inspection of something, that they're not going to miss something, even if it's an obvious defect. It's tempting to do that in this case. The judge heard the evidence and found it convincing. And I just think that from a legal standpoint, it's not supportable. And so I would join Commissioner Nakamura in his position.
I would reverse the judge's determination. It was not significant, substantial. I think both the reasons pointed out by my colleagues, especially Commissioner Young, that it wasn't locked out, tagged out, whether that would be enough to preclude a violation at all. But it clearly was a minor that it was going to be in use. Maybe not at that particular moment, but I think that is not enough to preclude the designation of significant substantial.
The last violation is the accumulation violation. On November 9, 2009, Inspector Hess issued citation number 8170394, alleging an SMS violation of 30 CFR section 75.400 for accumulation of combustible material on the 1A conveyor belt. The belt was turning in the accumulations, which were dry, and although indicated on the pre-shift report as needing cleaning, when the inspection took place, no cleaning after that. The judge found that the violation was not SMS because there had been no coal production and thus no ignition sources on November 7th and 8th, the 2 days prior to the inspection. And at the time of the inspection, the accumulations had been reported and miners were on their way to cleaning them up. The secretary argued that the judge infamously refused a certain abatement of the accumulation violation by assuming that because the accumulations had been reported in the pre-shift report, that the accumulations would be cleaned up shortly in the course of a normal mining operation. Not to create the response, but substantial evidence supports the judge's finding that miners were on their way to clean up the accumulations at the time of the inspection.
The belt was running.
The belt was running. The evidence indicates that the belt was turned on during the maintenance shift.
I would reverse this one for the same reasons I set out in my discussion of the previous citation, that the judge assumed the abatement, but the condition existed and the belt was running at the time of the citation. And he said there were no ignition sources during the previous shifts, but the evidence was that there were ignition sources right then and there, with rollers turning in the coal, as I recall. And we have, you know, a number of cases where we have found SNS in that very situation. And again, this is a situation where the violation itself has not been contested for some technical reason, like the belt was either not running or out of commission or something like that. So the fact that the belt was running, there are coal accumulations, there are ignition sources right then and there. It seems to me that based on that, I would reverse the judge.
Thank you, Commissioner Young.
This issue is a lot harder for me than the other issue on the abatement. And Linda, I really appreciate you laying out all the facts and the sequence of events and how it came that the belt was running. But ultimately, I would have to agree with Commissioner Nakamura on this, just because it's much more difficult for me because I have a position that you're not presuming abatement if abatement is underway. The question you have is whether abatement is sufficiently underway because people are on the way to fix the problem. And the difficulty for me is, as he's pointed out, is once the belt starts running, you set into motion the chain of events that could lead to the feared event. And that was the crucial point for me in this case on this issue. Again, if they had made some notation to say we're not going to turn the belt on until we get this cleaned up because we don't want the rollers turning into coal, it would be a lot more persuasive than I probably would hold differently. But the fact that the belt was turning and that the miners were not in place and were not addressing the accumulations at that point, it makes it difficult for me to affirm the judge's position in this, despite the fact that the secretary's representative testified that he didn't have any reason to doubt that they were in the process of getting people there to clean up the accumulations. This is kind of a policy note and something to think about, I guess, that if you have a maintenance shift and you have accumulations that have been noted, that's a good time to clean them up before you start running the belt. But I think this is the kind of case that we've looked at as being SNS. I might be more in favor of because I think his analysis is kind of short-circuited of remanding it. But I don't think we can affirm the judge in this case. I'm sorry to be so vague. I'm not sure whether I'll remand it or just go ahead and reverse it.
And I can appreciate that. I actually found this a little difficult to consider, to think about, because and I may still have to verify some things in the record, but Linda, what this is a Sunday evening, I think, the inspector arrived at the mine, so there was no production Sunday, and then maybe for the day before or something, but and I don't know if I understand correctly, the belts would not normally be on that Sunday evening, and then they would turned on at the inspector's request, or so he could inspect.
Said that testimony indicates the belt during the maintenance shift would not be on unless they were specifically
being serviced and would need to be turned on. Okay. In which case, then the inspector arrived, taking the normal force to help return back, and they would safely be part of the. Yeah, so that he could see if there were defective rollers or what, and turning in the coal. So, the point is also that the standard isn't just to clean up the accumulations, and I think that Circuit Court, on a D.C. Circuit, which circuit reminded us recently of that. I mean, the standard says don't allow it to accumulate. I mean, so you do have to clean up, but you're not supposed to allow it to accumulate. And I was wrestling a bit with this morning, thinking, well, all right, so they, the inspector had the belt running, but he needed to have the belt running to sort of check on the condition of things. So they let it accumulate to a point where, yeah, there's a problem. There's significant. I mean, it sounds to me from the description and the citation, there were fairly significant accumulations here. So that at some point when they stopped, whether it be Friday or Saturday, when they stopped, last stop running the belt, then they were running it in this condition. And so the question, so now they noted it in their pre-shift, which is good, but mind you, the pre-shift did occur while the inspector was in the mine. So they note the condition, the belt needs to be cleaned up while the inspector's in the mine, and then they proceed, one assumes they're going to clean it up, which is good, and would certainly lessen or perhaps negate determinations of, you know, maybe at least lessen some of the negligence and unwarrantability. It's good they note it, and we're going to clean it up. But that doesn't deny the fact that they let it get to a significant accumulation, and at some point they were running the belt in this accumulation prior to the inspector's arrival Sunday evening. I mean, this was how they left off their production. I mean, this, from the description of the accumulations here, you know, we don't, certainly is not the case that these accumulations occurred instantaneously when they started up the belt, when the inspector was there from spillage or something. So I did wrestle with this a bit, you know, kind of as the facts became a little more clearer as we studied the record, but I would still reverse the determination that there was no S&S, because I find on this record, given the extensive accumulations and the belt would have been running in it leading up to their maintenance shift. I mean, it's good they were going to address it on the maintenance shift, but this is, like I said, they let it accumulate to a point where it would be dangerous, and had it running, belt would be running in the accumulation.
Were the accumulations, were they noted at all on any previous inspection records? The on shift, the previous or previous pre-shift exam?
I have to check the record and see. The pre-shift where it was noted was the pre-shift for the outgoing day shift, which occurred between 3:30 and 6:30 in the morning. So it wasn't during the maintenance shift. It wasn't the pre-shift or on-shift for the maintenance shift where they noted that.
Right. It was going to be the pre-shift for the Monday morning, people coming in on Monday. I mean, the inspector was there, arrived Sunday evening, is what I
mean, I think you're making an excellent point. If the standard is prevent the accumulations, at some point you got to note it on an on shift that they have to be cleaned up, because you got to be watching for it. That's the standard. So.
Had the day shift started when the citation was written?
Yes. The day shift began at 7 o'clock. 7:09 when the citation was issued, the miners had dispatched to their
location. Hadn't gotten there yet, though.
Yes.
I
think the
testimony about
production
begins
at
7:30. There's no indication of when they would normally turn the belt on.
Okay.
Do you have any questions with us at this moment? I know there's quite a few violations, and you feel free to come back and clarify things with us individually. Certainly my door is open as you try and draft things. And I'm sure that's the same for my colleagues. Anything that you need to determine while you have us all here? All right. Thank you. I thank you again, Linda, and I thank my colleagues, and we will go off the record.